50% of my segments. If you'll think of it in that way, and you're tripling your segments, you're making a lot of money. And you're very psychologically comfortable, and you have some money in the bank. And speaking of psychological comfort, our next speaker is none other than our esteemed leader and guru, Dr. Howard Sartin, who is going to talk to you about the psychology of winning. Now, he always loves to give us a little introduction, so I'm going to give him one. Most of you are getting in. Yes, I've suffered through Schmidt and his damn record keeping. Now it's time. If I can just get through this one, I can go back. This is the most important part of this seminar. If you just walk in the door, like this gentleman is doing, right now, and had missed everything up to this point, you are further ahead than the guy who leaves right now. This is the difference between us and Dick Mitchell and everyone else who's doing seminars and writing books and all the rest of this stuff. Because Howard understands that it takes more to win at the races than knowing which horse is going to finish first. Here he is, the one and only, Howard.
This is 80% of all racing. How come you only leave me 15 minutes to do it?
No. I hit my mark. Don't be giving me that stuff.
Only 10 minutes over the straight line.
Yes, it was.
In short, we have all of your most follow-up subscribers, and you'll get enough of this in the follow-up. But in short, we have in this room a number of persons who are independently wealthy from building themselves up through gambling. I don't mean Dick Schmidt or any of the people you see up here. I'm talking about people like Steve George and Elton Smith and a number of you who are build up businesses and are independently wealthy and have deserved every dime you've made. But you didn't think of that as gambling. That was called business. You took the normal risks of business, which are higher than our normal risks in our endeavor, and you made it. Sure, you felt moments of trepidation, and you felt your kind of anxiety.
Hold that down, it booms.
Your kind of anxiety, sorry. I like to hear myself coming back. But it was not the same kind of anxiety that we as... if you have to use the term with quotes around it, gamblers. Why? Because it was ordained by society that you live in that what you were doing was legitimate, it was noble, it was honorable, and it was a thing to do. You get to join the Rotarians. You get to be a warden in the Roman Catholic or the Episcopal Church, or you get to be something in whatever church you're in. You're members of the city council, or you're kingmakers, or whatever. Dick said something about paying his bills, calling up the telephone company and saying, could you give me a month off? Because I got a big one coming in next weekend at Hialeah. Now, a businessman, if he has a little cash flow problem, he can call the phone company. He can call his landlord. They say, well, my business has a little cash flow interruption right now because of some orders that got in the snow up in Minneapolis. When they're delivered, I'll have an extra $350,000. Can I delay my payments? And they'll say, certainly, Mr. George. Why? Because you're in a legitimate, honorable business recognized by society as such. The word horse player or gambler to your peers in public society is anathema. Naughty word. The same mother who says, I got my son the stockbroker. Oh, I love it. He's so marvelous. He turns over $5 million for his clients every year. Some of them go broke, but that's the way it is. And then my dirty son, look, the horse player. He goes to the track in a big Cadillac with a big flowery shirt on, some of those big cigars, flashing all his money around. He's a bum. Why could he be by the other side? Overdone, maybe. But in its essence, that is society's regard for what we're doing. Any of you who are not affected by that are probably the Steve Georges and the Elton Smiths and the people who have, in their own hearts, know that they have gambled to make where they made it, just as much as we're gambling. They're immune to that. Tom Brohammer, for some miracle of his raising, is immune to that. He has no guilt feeling. My wife is not immune to that. My daughter is not immune to that. People come in, we don't have any pictures of horses and things. Anybody comes in, shh, don't tell them what we're doing. Hey, I'm surrounded by people. I really am, I'm telling you. I'm surrounded by people who are ashamed of what I'm doing. I should tell them I'm a towel boy in a brothel. That's a noble one. So anybody in this room who, I know some of you are not affected by this feeling of I'm doing something outside the bounds of social approval. But we are told, whether you remember it or not, I'm sure some of you do remember. We are told by society, by our mothers, fathers, great uncles, grandfathers, that what we're doing, gambling is evil, gambling is a sin, and always the retribution, especially in the Jewish and Christian household, and all gamblers lose. In the end, you lose. And they just wait for you to lose. They want to plunge on you. Society does. And these were injunctions you were given. Anybody in this room will stand up, other than the aforementioned, and say that you never got the message that gambling was evil? Great, good for you, Charlie. You're a winner. That's why you're a winner. Now I know. Okay, you never got that message. Never proceeded. You never went to church. You never went to church?
I played the piano.
You played the piano. Anybody who plays piano is immune from this. Even badly. But most of you are tacitly admitting that you have this message. From the preacher, the rabbi, the priest, the mother, the father, the uncle. How many of you remember a story when you were 5 or 6 years old that the women are talking and, did you hear about Dorothy? Her husband, Fred, he took all the money and he gambled it away. What a terrible thing. Or something that it could, or your uncle Charlie. But we don't talk about Uncle Charlie in this house. Uncle Charlie's down in Kentucky. He's going around living off those horses. Poor Uncle Charlie's gone to rack and ruin. We've all heard stories like this, and it affected us. It affected us. Why doesn't it affect the businessman? Because society says that his kind of gambling is noble and acceptable, and even if he goes broke, they write on his tombstone, he was a businessman, he went broke, but he tried. On our tombstone, he was a gambler, he went broke, he's a bum. You're with me on this, so you agree that this is with us. Why is it that the anxiety feeling you get when you anticipate the possibility of losing your bankroll in a gambling event so much more tightening, so much more destructive organically than the prospect of opening a business and going broke? Because one is perceived as an evil pursuit, and the other is perceived as a noble pursuit. What is this thing that really stands in our way, that keeps us from winning, that forces us to plunge the money back, forces us to play exactas when we know we can't win exactas, take all our winnings and give it back, or at the end of the day, oh yeah, I made $100, let's go out to dinner, let's spend it, oh, easy come, easy go, get rid of it, get rid of that money, because it's contaminated. In your subconscious mind, that contaminated money, and you have to figure a way to lose it. If you deny that, the only way to deny that successfully is to be a winner and appropriate this method and put the money away in what he said, CDs or treasury bonds or whatever. But we don't. What we do is, in effect, Mother said gambling was evil, and that all gamblers lose. A psychologist gets a hold of us and he says gambling is not evil. It's It's a noble, what we're doing is a noble endeavor. Okay, I'll accept that. But still, all gamblers lose. It's running around like a tape in our head. And when we get there and we throw the money away, it's not evil, Mom. You say, but you were right, Mom. All gamblers lose. See, Mom, I didn't do anything wrong. That's what you're in really saying. When you give away all that money, give it back, lose, you're saying society is right. Mom and Dad were right. The preacher was right. The rabbi was right. The priest was right. You're just saying you're relieving yourself of the guilt you get from winning. And you do have guilt. We all have guilt. So how do we cure this? By understanding the nature of anxiety. Anxiety was when the second man on earth saw the first man on earth die, he got a little fearsome. He didn't worry about the dinosaurs. Hey, they were there. Nobody told him they were dangerous or bad. He that was part of living in those days. I remember well. So man invented God. Now, I don't deny the possibility that God created man, but man had to create God in return to understand that he was there. And in creating God, man created an absolution for himself. That he created heaven. I don't deny that. I'm not being atheistic about that. Maybe God did it first, but man had to perceive that it was done in order for God to be known unto man. He didn't come down with a big bellowing voice. He gave his message more subtly. I've talked to him about that, I know. So, we perceive a heaven, and we perceive a hell, and so to excuse the fact that when we die, there is some place to go to live a wonderful life in eternity. The hell part is that if the gamblers go to hell, and broken businessmen go to heaven, in our lexicon. Anxiety is the fear, essentially, then, of death. It doesn't matter whether it's death of the body or death after the fifth race. What's a term we notice in our profession? I'm dying out here. How many of you have ever heard somebody say or said to yourself, geez, I'm dying. You know, when Truman died, and the former president Truman died, they had a big announcement at a racetrack where we all paused for 60 seconds and bow our heads in memory of former President Harry Truman. In the middle of the 60 seconds, the guy said, what are we worried about him for? I'm dying out here in the infield. That's what the title of Annie Barr's new book is in. I'm dying out here in the infield. So we associate losing a race with dying. And dying is the fear of death or fear of loss or fear of the unknown, which is both of these things constitute, is really what we fear. We don't fear losing the race. We fear losing our perspective, ourselves, our dignity, our ego, or whatever you want to call it, by having made the wrong choice. To a gambler, or a horse race better, which I don't think it's gambling, but it's perceived as such, so let's call it that. To a gambler, making an inaccurate decision is far more destructive than losing the money. Please ask yourself right now. You open the racing form, do you start to tremble a little bit? Before the race, you start to get a little anxiety, little feelings. You haven't made a dime worth money bet, but you think, and sometimes the racing form kind of clouds before your eyes, and it gets blurry. And you're thinking to yourself, well, how am I doing this for? Nobody can beat these things. And it gets all mixed up in your mind. You haven't even thought about the bet. How many of you, when you lose, does the amount you lose really, really bother you? You don't have to raise your hand, but ask yourself that. Is the amount I am losing bothering me? I spend more on the meals for friends and drinks for friends. I don't drink much myself anymore, but I used to spill more than other people drank, but I kind of got cut down. So it isn't that the money doesn't bother me. If I lose $300 at a dinner table, doesn't bother me a bit. The thought of losing $300 at the races? Did you ever hear about the starving Armenians?
Yeah.
You didn't eat all your dinner? The starving Armenians. Hey, I don't want to eat it. Put it in a package and send it to them.
No, it's starving somebody. No, it was Armenians when I was a kid. We don't fear the money we lost. We fear the loss of a piece of ourselves for making an incorrect decision. We must then reframe our mind. We have a psychological term called cathexis. We have several ego states. The ego state of child, the free child, above the kid who can't lose. I mean, he's great. But what happens to that free child, the one that doesn't have anxiety, the one that the world is his oyster, puts his finger in the old electric plug, and if it shocks him to death, so what? Until this free child is corrupted, contaminated by parental injunctions. No, don't put your finger in there. Don't do this. Don't do that. Don't do this. You go blind. No, everything. Don't. We live in a world of don'ts and no's. And every time we go against one of those no's that was pounded into us from birth, we have another child that takes over from our free child, and that's our adapted child. The adapted child can only get its strokes, can only get its feelings of recognition, its feelings of happiness by having done something for the parental figure who says, now nice Johnny, nice Mary. We want recognition. We need recognition to live, and so we adapt to whatever strokes are there to get it. Thus we come into the world contaminated by the generation before us. And we're contaminated by no's. We also have within us the capacity to be an adult reasoning body just like a computer. No emotions, very dull. It's something you have to be able to connect to when you need to make adult, rational decisions. Then we have the parent. We then emulate the parents before us. Usually, have you ever noticed when you're scolding your kids, does it ever occur to you that you're scolding them just like your mommy and daddy scolded you? Or you go to the other extreme. Well, I was scolded when I was a kid. I'll never, no discipline in the house at all. The place is ruined. The kids have no discipline because I was so tormented by my parental disciplining that I'll never discipline. But usually we find ourselves with the same gestures. You know, no, we have the pointing finger, the mother who pointed finger, the grandmother who pointed finger, produces kids who point fingers. Really? I must have touched on us. And we find ourselves brutalizing our own children the way we were brutalized. Not necessarily physically, but emotionally. So we carry with us a great deal of contamination. The contamination as it affects us is people who, in their adult stage, in their pure computer form, are excellent handicappers. Not one person in this room who is as good a handicapper as any of us. The real problem is that because of your, you think you're doing something contaminated, you force your mind not to perceive that which you could perceive at home. Let me ask you one question. How many of you can win on paper at home? Come on. It's a cinch at home on paper. Some of you didn't raise your hand. You're winning not only at home, but in the track. How many of you cannot win on paper at home? Okay, then. You should have all raised your hands on the other question. You can all win on paper at home because you know why? There is no sin attached to winning on paper at home. It becomes a mathematical, a chess game. And it's okay. Molly said, that's okay. You're solving mathematical problems. The minute you get to the track, what happens? What was the rationale? It works at home on paper, but it doesn't work at the track. Wrong. You work at home on paper, but you don't work at the track. You suddenly become anesthetized by the crowd, by the ambience of the track, and all gambling parlors have it. You walk in, and you're intimidated. The noise, the crowd, the hints, the tips, this and that, that causes your decision-making properties of your mind to become that little frightened, adapted child. instead of the adult you were at home. We have to go back and repair it ourselves. Hey, you don't get mad at your mother and daddy. You don't get mad at your wife for nagging you for going to the track that she doesn't understand. She wants to be your mother. Most of us marry our mothers. Most of you have problems with your spouse. It's because you married a parent. Now, if you're gonna take it out on your parents, take it out on your husband and wife. Get it over with. We have a thing called divorce therapy. If anybody wants it, we'll give it to you. Either you've got to have the approval of that parent you married, or you got to quit. You can't keep your marriage together if you don't have approval. You've got to repair it yourself to say what is truth. What is more noble or truth than to go out and with your own skill, with your own determination, to play the fairest game in the world, the pari-mutuel game? It does not reward the rich businessman or the influential. You walk up to a teller sometime and say, "My name is Steve George, and I bet the three, but I meant to bet the two. Would you please pay me off?" He might be able to get away with that in business. So I'm not picking on Steve. It's just that we all know he's a very successful independent businessman. You walk up and say, I'm the crab tree, the horse player, and I wanted to bet the two, and you give me a three. Please pay me on the two. No, you can't buy it. You can't do it in bedrooms, boardrooms, or backroom skills. You did it, or you didn't do it. And you get paid off if you're right, and you get not paid off if you're wrong. That is the most noble thing. Isn't that what they told us when we were kids? Anybody can grow up to be president or the president's mistress or wife or whatever. This is the real world. We get paid for our skills in this world. It is the essence of democracy. It is the essence of Christianity. It's the essence of communism or any ism. It's the essence of every ideal that you should be rewarded for your ability. It is not a sin. It is not ignoble. It is honorable. And once you get it through your heads and you talk to yourself and you say it is honorable and you believe it is honorable, you will all be able to do better at the track than you do at home on paper. So let's vow from this day forward that we will look upon our profession with pride and nobility, and we will live up to the highest standards of that profession, which is taking your due profit. What do you say? We go to the bus and start that philosophy at work today. All right. Thank you. All right.